Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's program, The Minnesota Paradox, Progressivism and Inequalities. I'm Larry Jacobs. I'm a faculty at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. I'm also director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, which is bringing you today's program. We do many programs, and I want to just mention a few that are coming up in the next month. President Obama's political guru, David Axelrod, will be joining us with Minnesota Republican Vin Weber on July 9th at noon. We have a program coming up on Black Lives Matter in the 2020 elections with Ashley Jardina from Duke, Christopher Parker from the University of Washington, LaFour Stevens Dugan from Princeton, and my colleague in the Department of Political Science here, Michael Minta, who will be moderating and has organized that terrific panel. We also have a program coming up on healthcare, which is part of our series. This is looking at innovation during the COVID pandemic. And it's going to include Craig Samet, who's president and CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Minnesota and prominent Democrat and Republican in the Minnesota State Senate. And then at the end of the month, July 29th, we have a program on American conservatism on July 29th, as I mentioned, and that includes Peter Weiner, who's a well-known conservative, and he's at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and David Hopkins, who's at Boston College. I'm very pleased to welcome as today's moderator and participant, Dr. Michael Hung. And I want to acknowledge as I do that, that this program is supported by the Scholars Strategy Network. Dr. Hung is a good friend of ours. She is a collaborator with some of our programs, and we're grateful that she is participating today. Dr. Hung is the Dean of the College of Health at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Previously, she was president and CEO of the Wilder Foundation in Minnesota, and she chaired the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank's Board of Directors. Dr. Hung, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. I thought I would set some context for this conversation that we have. In all of my different roles in the community and also in academia, it's really clear that though Minnesota has had a history of progressivism, being progressive and taking actually very progressive action, we are near the bottom for our racial disparities in the state of Minnesota. So today we're joined by two experts, Dr. Sam Myers, who is Roy Wilkins Professor of Human Relations and Social Justice, who also directs the Roy Wilkins Center for Human Relations and Social Justice. He specializes in the impacts of social policies on the poor. And Dr. Myers is an economist and pioneer in the use of applied econometric techniques and really coined the term Minnesota paradox. So we'll hear from him. And we will also be hearing from Dr. Joe Thoss, who is Cole's chair for the study of public service at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Joe is drawing on his many years of training as a political scientist and sociologist. He has studied extensively the politics of social inequities and public policy, and he's currently working and co-authoring a book called Preying on the Poor, which really describes how the criminal justice practices in the U.S. have been made into tools for turning resources from poor communities of color into corporate profits for government revenues. So I'd like to welcome you both and just say how delighted I am to actually be able to moderate this really esteemed group of individuals to have this conversation. So I'm gonna turn it over to Dr. Myers first, because he coined this term Minnesota paradox. And I'd like you to spend, Dr. Myers, 7 to 10 minutes summarizing your thoughts and arguments about the Minnesota paradox.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's clear that I was as surprised as everybody else was when I moved to Minnesota in 1992, because it turns out that the name of this school is the Hubert Humphrey, you know, School of Public Affairs, and Hubert Humphrey was the floor leader for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Hubert Humphrey, when he was the mayor of the city of Minneapolis, was a outspoken advocate for racial justice. And so I was really surprised when I got here. This great state of Minnesota, one of the best places in the world to live, to raise your kids, beautiful lakes, wonderful schools, fantastic cultural scene. I really tell you, I was surprised when I discovered the wide racial gaps in virtually every measure of social and economic well-being. Unemployment, sentencing, incarceration, test scores, even drowning rates. Minnesota had the highest black drowning rate in the country. And how's that possible for this to be such a great place to live for the majority and for there to be such wide racial gaps? And one of the things I discovered that I talk about in my book, Race Neutrality, is that it wasn't always this way. That these wide racial gaps in things like home ownership did not always exist. In fact, in the 1930s and 1940s, the black home ownership rate was the highest of any state in the country. And the gap between black and white home ownership rates was much, much narrower in 1930, 1940 than it was by 2000. And so some of the questions that we need to raise that I'm very much looking forward to my colleague, Dr. Joe Sauce, is why? How did it get that way? And that's why we're here today to have a conversation with you, talking about the various explanations that have been offered for the paradox of being, number one, one of the best places in the world to live for whites, but number two, being, relatively speaking, one of the worst places for blacks to live. Now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Sauce.
Dr. Sauce?
Thank you. I want to start by just saying thanks to the Center for organizing this event. And I also want to say that when you take a job at a university, there are certain things that are things that you'll be doing, duties that are not written into the contract. And I didn't know when I came to the Humphrey School that one of the things that wasn't written into the contract was that I would spend a tremendous amount of my time being grateful to and thanking Dr. Myers for having spent years, decades pushing on issues that other people were not pushing and drawing our attention to them and forcing us to reckon with them. So today is one opportunity to publicly say that. I want to start by directing our attention 100 years ago from today, back to 1920. This, of course, was the end of the Progressive Era and all the movements associated with it. People here in Minnesota in particular had all sorts of strikes and protests and battles in legislatures and courts. They broke up monopolies and fought the power of robber barons. They regulated workplace safety. They established minimum wages, expanded access to the vote, reformed governing institutions. For white Minnesotans, 1920 was the end of three decades of pursuing and achieving in many ways a greater share of wealth, prosperity, and the power to be self-governing. But in these very same decades, if we look back 100 years, Native Americans in Minnesota were continuing to suffer the violent dispossession of land and culture as the Dawes Act became national law, and as white Minnesotans forcibly abducted indigenous children and put them in these horrific boarding schools. For black Minnesotans, 1920 saw the brutal lynchings of Elias Clayton and Elmer Jackson and Isaac Guthrie in Duluth, and 3 years later, Jack Trice came to the Twin Cities as the first black football player for Iowa State. And as the spokesman recorder reported at the time, the Ku Klux Klan rallied at the stadium that day and had its own float in the homecoming parade. The Minnesota Gopher football players assaulted Trice on the field so viciously that he died shortly after the game from the complications. And of course, by 1920, white Minneapolis residents and St. Paul residents had already entered into more than 1,400 restrictive covenants, making binding agreements to only sell their houses to other white people. Within a decade, that number would be 9,000 in Hennepin County, and by 1955, it would be over 21,000. So while homeownership was at some level of equality, who had what kind of houses in what neighborhoods was not. And so here we are, a century from 1920, gathering to ponder the Minnesota paradox. How can Minnesota, with all its progressive policies and attitudes and all its high quality of life indicators, be a national leader in racial inequalities across so many critical areas of social, political, and economic life? And the short answer I want to suggest is that this is how white Minnesotans built this state all along the way. Viewed from certain perspectives, we can see this as a paradox, but we don't need to see it as a mystery. I think we have to start by connecting rather than just comparing outcomes for different groups. So indigenous people didn't just get left out of white progress in Minnesota. White wealth and security and opportunity were, in an important sense, created by subjugating and stealing from Native Americans in ways that led directly to their poverty and immiseration. Black-white disparities today reflect in part decisions about how to invest in black and white communities, as well as the wealth that white people created for themselves by exploiting needs and problems and desperations in black communities that whites themselves had often created. In other words, if we shift our way of thinking from group comparisons and disparities, who does better, who does worse, to group relations, who has done what to whom, we begin to see the Minnesota paradox in a different way. White people in Minnesota have done very well in many respects because of how they have exploited and impoverished communities of black, indigenous, and other people of color. In a state that's disproportionately white, these dynamics are going to produce overall indicators of success that look great, right? Because most of the people are white, alongside very large disparities between whites and other racialized groups. But of course, you could tell this story for a lot of states. You could say this about most states in the U.S. So why are Minnesota's racial disparities so big compared with other states? The answer, in part, I want to suggest, lies in the very same progressive policies that make so many people surprised by the Minnesota paradox. To understand why Minnesota has nation-leading black-white disparities, we have to begin by reminding ourselves of what this disparity actually measures. It's the difference between black and white outcomes. These disparities can go up either because black people do worse in Minnesota or because white people do better in our state relative to others. And this is critical because in a lot of areas, Minnesota's high disparities are actually driven not by black people doing significantly worse in Minnesota than in other states, but actually by white people doing significantly better in Minnesota than other states. Consider a comparison between Minnesota and Alabama. On incarceration and education and all sorts of other things, Minnesota has racial disparities that are by a country mile larger than what Alabama produces. Is this because Alabama is somehow a land of opportunity that provides a high quality of life for black people? No. Mostly it's a reflection of how poorly most white people fare in Alabama, a state where taxes are low and regressive and social investments of all sorts are very weak. Whether one is looking at education or incarceration, the numbers for black people in Alabama and Minnesota are so bad they should just stop you in your tracks and force you to, you know, scream. But in Alabama, the numbers for white people are also rotten. Whereas in Minnesota, the numbers for white people stand out as far better than the national average.
Mm-hmm. So Joe, I'm gonna stop you there because I think you've brought up a really good point, which is the size of the disparities are perhaps larger in Minnesota, and that it's their persistence over time and over categories that really matters. So your argument is really that we should look more so at relationships and how we're treating each other. Dr. Myers, you have actually measured such relationships using some of the research that you have done over the years to really look at the data and look at the evidence of what policies have created the type of racial inequality that we are experiencing in Minnesota. Could you talk about the major factors that are driving the inequality in terms of racial disparities and the persistence of that over time?
Well, Dr. Stiles is absolutely correct that on most of the measures of social economic well-being. The reason why the gap is so large between blacks and whites, between indigenous people and whites. I mean, every socioeconomic minority group faces exactly the same gap. I think blacks face some of the biggest gaps. And the reason why we know so little about the gaps among indigenous people is that people use the current population survey, American Community Survey, in order to do their statistical analysis. And we've wiped out, we have virtually eliminated large portions of the indigenous community. But with that said, Dr. Sauce is absolutely correct that for many of these indicators of socioeconomic well-being, the reason for the wide gap in Minnesota as compared to the gaps elsewhere is because whites are doing very well. And so the question is, why are whites doing so very well? Okay, and part of the dilemma that I come from as a black economist is the fact that economists as a group have paid more attention to what's wrong with black people. And so they say between blacks and whites, and it kind of turns into a discussion about what's wrong with black people. What is it that's causing them to do so poorly? Is it because they are lazy? Is it because they are less intelligent? Is it because they take advantage of social welfare programs and engage in perverse behaviors like withdrawing from the labor market, like having babies out of wedlock? I mean, that's kind of actually a dominant view within the economics profession, that the reason why there's a gap between blacks and whites is there's something wrong with black people. So can I take that as a starting point? If there is something wrong with black people, you should be able to measure it, right? And so much of my career has been spent using standard econometric techniques in order to parse out how much of the gap between blacks and whites can be attributable to differences in productivity, differences in qualities, even differences in time that you use working. And what I've discovered is that most of the gap can't be explained. There's differences. And there's a word that we use in economics literature to describe this unexplained gap. And I know it's offensive. I realize that not everybody agrees. I realize that in Minnesota, not everybody agrees. But the economics literature has a word to describe situations where statistically you control for all of the observable characteristics that might legally or economically matter and explain the gap. And the part that's left over, the residual unexplained gap, has a word. And it's called discrimination. Let me explain why it's harder to use the word discrimination. And by the way, I didn't say racism. I said discrimination, where I define discrimination as differential treatment of identically situated individuals. The reason why in Minnesota it's so very difficult to allege that these gaps are due to discrimination is that in Minnesota, people deeply believe in egalitarianism. They believe in fairness. And their response is, this is not Alabama. This is not Mississippi. This is Minnesota. About good people. And we're not discriminators. And heaven forbid if you allege that we're racist. And here's my response. It is possible for there to be racial discrimination without there being a discriminator. It's possible for there to be racism without there being a racist. Now, let me explain what I mean here. What I mean is that institutions begin to reproduce outcomes even without having a typical racist. So Dr. Sauce mentions the lynching. Let me explain, you're far more likely to be lynched in Alabama than you were to be lynched in Minnesota. I just want to be very clear. Mm-hmm. A tough task to convince our elected officials, to convince our business leaders, to convince individuals in the finance industry, the banking industry, is that I'm not accusing anybody of being racist. Mm-hmm. I'm not accusing anybody of being a bigot.
So Dr. Myers, I'm gonna cut you off because
inequality.
I'm gonna cut you off because I think that you made an excellent point, which is, you know, I've heard of people of color who moved to this community call Minnesota nice, Minnesota ice. And it's the icy cold shoulder treatment with just a benign neglect or not being included in decision-making circles. So the history of being progressive and what Minnesota has typically been known for, very liberal, and has not necessarily served us well. So some of the chatter on social media and actually about this particular forum is, how are we not being tangible enough with the words that we use, and how some of the reproduction of inequality in the systems that you're talking about is actually continuing to disenfranchise different populations. And of course, you know, we have new immigrant communities and refugee communities. So I'm actually Hmong, and I was born in the country of Laos and came in the 70s. So as an Asian American in the fastest growing demographic in the state of Minnesota, actually, the conversations around race and poverty often just exclude conversations about new immigrants, refugees, and actually first gen, second gen, and then, you know, the growing population in Minnesota is really a growing East African population. So Dr. Sloss, can you speak to the Minnesota ICE? How has poverty really been racialized in America, and how do systems or policies continue to perpetuate some of the what Dr. Myers is talking about?
Yeah, so let me take us back a little bit historically, and back to the question of why are disparities so much higher in Minnesota? And I'd like to start with a landmark book written by a former president of the American Political Science Association, Ira Katz Nelson. It's called When Affirmative Action Was White. And the point of the book, which is national in scope, is that the most generous and progressive social policies and policy interventions of the 20th century happened at times and in ways that they were really, in a sense, functioned as investments in white communities. They were directed at white communities, and black, indigenous, and other people of color tended to be excluded, particularly black people. And so, in many ways, the answer to the Minnesota paradox is buried in that paradox. The fact that we had such progressive policies here lifted white communities up relative to other communities because of exclusion. And I just want to say there's three dimensions to this exclusion. I'll just stop there. But the three are, first of all, there was social exclusion in the sense of that Dr. Myers talked about, discrimination against groups and individuals, wherever those policies were. Second, exclusion had a spatial dimension in that here, as in many places outside the South, whites built systems of residential segregation that then allowed for differential investment and increased our disparities. The more generous those investments were in white communities, once again, it increased those disparities. And then the last dimension, which most people don't think about, is the time dimension. As recently as 1970, 1.8% of Minnesota's population was classified by the census as non-white. In 1980, it was 3.8%. Right, and so most of our populations that are black and other people of color in the United in Minnesota came after that period, right? Rose up in the state after that period, and so in Minnesota, the eras of great social investment were eras of primarily white populations, and large amounts of our black and brown populations in Minnesota arrived after that during the period of austerity politics, when investments at the bottom were drying up and policies were favoring the top, and inequality was spiraling and wealth and income were becoming concentrated at the top. So in these all three of these ways, social, spatial, and in terms of time, there was a kind of separation between the investments that lifted up whites, right, and everybody else.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, the concentrated investments over a period of time in white communities just left other populations behind. Dr. Myers, I know you've looked nationally at some of this. Is Minnesota so different than other states? In other words, is Joe right that our disparities are so large because the tide that lifted the boats lifted them in a timely manner for the white population of Minnesota and for Black populations and others, Indigenous populations in Minnesota? Let's not even talk about the Asian American population for now. Is that true? And are we worse than other states across the nation?
I agree with the bulk of what Dr. Sosa said, but with one minor exception. It's kind of like the impression that the progressive policies themselves are what produce the racial gaps. I'm going to try to demonstrate, and this is what my life's work is, man, that in some complex way, the disparities produce the progressive responses. And so look at the aftermath of the riots in the city of Minneapolis and the outflow of funding, of initiatives, of plans, of corrective mechanisms and letters all over from the CEOs of the top corporations, all expressing outrage at this significant problem of racial gaps. But you see, it turns out that every single time we have a massive crisis, a racial conflict, the progressive policies flow with the intention, at least the initial intention, of narrowing the racial gaps. And I can give you a number of different illustrations, but one of them has to do with child abuse and neglect. Somebody produced a report, it may have been me, that showed that Minnesota had the highest racial gap in reported child abuse and neglect. And I would really let you know that it was tough getting money from the National Institute of Health in order to do this serious piece of analysis, because the reviewers said, Minnesota, who cares about Minnesota? If it's New York, if it's California, if it's Texas, we'll give you money to do research. But Minnesota, who cares? And my answer to the question, who cares, that Minnesota had the highest racial gap and reported child abuse and neglect. Well, guess what? After the study, the state legislature mandated an annual report. And the report was a report on disparities. And then all of the child protective services began to mandate racial equity training, that this was various sorts of acknowledgement that there's a problem, trying to rethink why and how there was a problem. But the irony of it is that, A, these progressive responses are often short-lived. Mm-hmm. And B, the responses are not about the problem. The problem, as Dr. Sells correctly said, was the fact that whites are privileged. If you develop a policy response that is baked into the idea that the racial gap is due to something about our small minority growing, but still small minority.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think actually, this is, we know, for example, because I am the founding dean of the College of Health at the University of St. Thomas, if you've just joined us, and Dr. Samuel Myers, who's an economist, and Dr. Joe Saucer talking about the Minnesota paradox, we know that good health also equals wealth. The opportunity to be employed, to be served, to have insurance. We also know that there's this thing that's a public safety net. We just got a question from one of our viewers around public benefits and the safety net system that's been built around human beings. And Joe, I know this has been an area of study that you've had for many years. And what really has struck me over the years of working in government and in nonprofit systems serving those who are low income, particularly families and seniors, is that there is often the execution of the policies with good intent, but a different mindset, maybe defining the problem in the wrong way, as in terms of stigmatizing and what you call disciplining the poor, really trying to get attitudes and behaviors to shift when the numbers just really don't work. I mean, how have our safety net systems and how we've crafted policies over time in public welfare really perpetuated the gap and or led to solutions?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, this goes back to what I was talking about before, which is that we need to see this on two sides. I think, as Dr. Myers rightly said, you know, on one side, these disparities result from a history of repression and a history of reaction and all that. And on the other hand, they also reflect the way in which progressive policies have been targeted differently at different racial groups. And so I think if you look at the policies that have really lifted people, either by creating opportunities or by creating strong protections, those have been policies in the United States that have been that have covered more white people, where white people have predominated, and in some cases, Social Security, old age insurance, in its early years, actually actively excluded, particularly black people, from those protections. And then the pattern you see repeatedly across social programs, whether you look at child welfare or cash welfare programs, whatever it is, that when people begin to either in reality or symbolically associate a program with people of color, particularly black people, those policies become politically attacked. They become far less generous in their supports, and they move toward the kind of rules and regulations you were describing, Mike Howe, as disciplining, that you know, really, as Dr. Meyer said, treat the problem as if it resides in the individuals, in their attitudes and choices and behaviors, and try to correct the individual, try to discipline them instead of opening opportunities.
So Joe, does the you know, I have a question from one of the audience members. I mean, you know, I've often heard over the years that our really generous public benefits are incentivizing poor black and brown people to move to Minnesota and maybe Asian folks too, like myself. I mean, what has your research shown related to that?
Yeah, I've been involved earlier in my career in a fair amount of welfare migration research. There's not very good evidence that there's much of it at all. Most people don't move all that much. When they do move, they tend to move. Poor people tend to move for reasons like a lot of other people, for reasons of employment and opportunities, for reasons of family, because there's a community of immigrants that looks like them and comes from the same place as them. All sorts of reasons that really don't have much to do with the fact that there's $15 more a month in welfare benefits. And it's important to realize here that, you know, all of these stories about welfare benefits incentivizing people to move to another state, to have an additional child, to not work, to do all these things, really require sort of blinding yourselves to the complexity of full human lives and acting as if this person in some way can be boiled down to wanting just those few extra dollars in some sort of way. And in reality, many of those predictions don't work out in empirical studies.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. So, Dr. Myers, can we achieve income equity without achieving racial equity? That's what we're talking about here. And you know, I often am in all white groups, sometimes all people of color groups. You know, because of the roles that I've had over time, and oftentimes people have so racialized poverty to be black or to be people of color, they forget. And they forget that the majority of poor Americans are actually still white. So can we achieve economic equity or some form of it without achieving racial equity?
I'm saying be very careful about what you ask for.
I know that's a provocative question.
Intergroup inequality are very different things. Mm-hmm. They interact in complex ways. Even during the Obama administration, there was kind of the belief that you can solve the intergroup inequality problem, meaning the black-white gap, by dealing with the intragroup inequality, and that's the overall widening of the gap between the top and the bottom. And I think this is really dangerous, but it is a symptom of progressive policies, because progressive policies say, if we can solve the problem of racial inequality by solving the problem of overall inequality, then we don't need to talk about race. We could bypass our discussion of race. And so my answer to your question is, let's be clear that the evidence does not support the idea that if, and this is the rising tide lifts all ships phenomenon, if you narrow the gaps, if you provide overall levels, like you give everybody $1,000 at birth, like a baby born, I mean, you know, that's an interesting idea. And even one of the presidential candidates suggested that. But that's not going to solve the problem of intergroup inequality. And I'm going to tell you why. Because the reason why intergroup inequality persists from generation to generation is rooted in ownership. It's rooted in wealth. And the problem is that the wealth inequality isn't going to change until or unless there's an explicit redistribution of wealth through something like reparations, or B, through the vigorous enforcement of existing laws that have the effect of the existing anti-discrimination laws, which currently aren't being enforced, that have the effect of creating persistence of inequality. And so I have argued time and time again about something small that we can do without dismantling capitalism, without having complete revolution, something really small that we can do. And that is to enforce the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which prohibits discrimination in mortgage lending, because banks are powerful in this state. Banks are powerful in America. I mean, the largest banks are able to dictate policies within the state and local governments, because state and local governments have to pay their bills. They have to invest their money. And it turns out that both City of St. Paul and the City of Minneapolis passed ordinances called responsible banking. And responsible banking says, in order for a bank to do business with us, they can't discriminate. In order for a bank to do business with us, they have to allocate some proportion of their loans to disadvantaged communities, to small businesses that are located in the inner city. And it turns out that once that report came out and it said that Wells Fargo got a D, that US Bank got an F, that Twin Cities Federal God, I think a C minus. I mean, people were outraged, and their comments were, how is it possible for U.S. Bank to get a failing grade when U.S. Bank has an ATM machine on the corner of Lake and Chicago? And my response is, you know, having ATM machines on Lake and Chicago is actually a small portion of the grade about how well banks are doing. Okay, so what is this about? The vast majority of Americans hold their wealth in a home. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a home, then you don't have access to that form of wealth. Why is home ownership actually quite good in intergenerational transmission of socioeconomic status? It's because the parent who owns their home can use that home as equity for things like education or down payment for their kids' home and other things. So how do people get homes? Unlike in China, unlike in other countries where people in Singapore, where people use their savings in order to purchase a home. In the United States, people borrow money. They get mortgages. And then the next thing is, well, why is it that blacks are not getting loans? And it turns out that for a long time, people couldn't answer the question. Mm-hmm. They couldn't answer the question because the data didn't include relevant information that bankers were using in order to make their decisions. And so now, all of a sudden, we have the information, and we still find that there is racial discrimination in mortgage lending. It is non-trivial. It's not the largest factor, but it's an important factor. So that question is, why can't we get rid of racial discrimination? And the answer is, oh, no, we don't discriminate. What we use is we use desktop underwriting. We use algorithms. We use the computer. And so it's the computer that's discriminating. And my response was, where did that computer model come from?
Yeah.
The information from the computer models actually comes from the past. And so you baked in, you reproduce racial discrimination without even having a discriminator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Myers is one of our experts today, and he is Roy Wilkins Professor of Human Relations and Social Justice, and directs the Roy Wilkins Center for Human Relations and Social Justice, and is a very well-respected social policy person within academia and also outside in terms of his thinking around using economic tools and analysis to figure out what is actually going on so that we can move towards solutions. So his point is really that we have some remedies that are possible and within reach, but we need to actually make them visible and to enforce them. So I agree from all the work that I've done that access to capital for home ownership is a primary way that many families get going. And obviously, Dr. Joe Soss, who's Cole's chair for the study of public service at the Humphrey School, drawing on all his experiences, both as a political scientist and as a sociologist, would likely agree that the relationships we have and, you know, sometimes just who we know in terms of getting our foot in the door with a loan or actually to access a particular benefit that might have been excluded for a poor family can often make a huge difference. So I'm just going to take this and be very personal and say, you know, I grew up on the north end of St. Paul, working class neighborhood. I hit about 200% of poverty in the 10th grade, which meant that I went from free lunch to reduced lunch. So I had to pay 10 cents for lunch as a sophomore in high school. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that meant. It meant that my parents had reached a level of in earnings that put me in a different income strata. I had never experienced that before. But because one of the recent reports, or, you know, you can look at lots of studies about the 7-county metropolitan region in particular, but I think this is the hotbed that we're living in with the history of economic, social, and racial segregation in Minnesota. If you look at some of the fair housing studies and where people are spatially located in the 7-county area, it shows that we're not just economically segregated, but that we're socially and racially very segregated. And actually in the 7-county area, one of the most segregated areas within a large metropolitan area. Joe, what is that, you know, because your point before was really around relationships and kind of shifting the research question. What can you say about how, when we as a region become so segregated, how we can actually move towards solutions? What solutions do you have for us?
Well, so let me start by picking up on Dr. Meyer's point about housing, because I think it's a good example.
Yes.
It's one thing to say, well, here's a disparity between two groups, say a black-white disparity. It's a good next step to talk about exclusion, which is what people usually want to talk about, which is that some people have gotten good things and they've other people have been excluded from it, all right, on a racial basis. But what people don't do is often is take that next step of putting it in more relational terms, talking about one group preying on the other. So it's not just that, as Dr. Myers rightly said, that black people were not allowed the ability to get the loans, right? It's also that once they were excluded from those loans, it set up the basis for what many scholars call predatory inclusion. once you're excluded from something you really need, it sets the stage for people to go in and offer you all kinds of predatory deals. And so Black people did have access to loans. They had access to loans and access to home ownership for loans that destroyed their lives financially, homes that fell apart and became monetary sinkholes and that they couldn't sell to improve their standing as white people. So all of that, the predatory aspect has to be part of this. And so I think as we think about solutions, we need to be thinking about both of these sides. We need to be thinking about solutions that open up access to things that people have been excluded from, but also that say, look, if you're being excluded from normal banking terms, we also need to regulate the predatory payday lenders and other people that come in and take advantage of your desperation to strip money out of your community in various ways. So we need to close off the predatory responses and we need to open up the markets to those who are being denied them.
Yeah,
but the only way the predatory lenders can make the money is if the bank lenders are excluding the group. And turns out that really high credit, high quality borrowers, recognizing a distinction between going to payday lender as opposed to being turned down by a big lender, will just stay out of the market altogether. They end up running and they end up not reproducing wealth from one generation to the next. But because they are excluded, you don't see the good borrowers. You don't see the people with good credit. And what the analyst sees, all they see is the bad.
Yeah.
And it kind of creates and sustains the stereotype that Black people have bad credit.
So it occurs to me that as Minnesotans, we like to be very abstract. We're kind of an intellectual state. I can't tell you how many conversations I've been in when we are intellectualizing race and poverty effects, and the people in the community just really want to know, if I go to the convenience store and I buy something, am I going to be harmed as a result, you know, because of the neighborhoods that they're living in? So that's the reality for our children, actually, who are living in some of these areas, North Minneapolis, Frogtown, South Minneapolis. Public education is another really big lever for change. Knowledge, as we know, is power. And nationwide, we graduate half our young from high school, nationwide. In the city of Minneapolis, where George Floyd was murdered, the district is graduating 60%, 67% of our students. So there are a lot of kids of color. St. Paul, it's not too much better. There are too many kids of color who are a bit left behind at the starting line of economic success. And you know, some of this, now I experienced this myself as the CEO of Wilder, but still today, if you don't have a decent place to lay your head and you're worried about where you're going to find your family at the end of the day, you're having a hard time in school. Can we have more equity in Minnesota without addressing the achievement gap? And how would you suggest that we do so using some of the research that you have conducted over the years? I mean, I think we've tried many things over the years, vouchers, different subsidies, you know what I mean? But because of the spatial, the social and the time dimensions related to this, and the issues are very much in the current here and now, I think the audience is really interested in understanding what can we do right now, I mean, on these structural issues, especially as it relates to public education. I'm open to either of you commenting on that. I know it's a very broad topic.
Well, I'll just start by saying that you can't disentangle education from all the other things. I mean, the greatest predictors of how people do in our schools are their social position, not just race, but poverty and class and other sorts of social positioning. In many ways, educational institutions reproduce the social inequalities that we already have. And I think that it's really important here to, if I can use a metaphor that people in my field sometimes use to study inequality, the game of musical chairs, right? You can have a game of musical chairs with 10 chairs and 12 people, and I can take out the two people who keep losing and not getting a chair, and I can train them. I can educate them. I can teach them to watch for a signal of when the person's going to stop the music and to be quicker off their foot to get into the chair. And I may be able to show. In fact, I might be able to do a randomized controlled trial, you know, gold standard evidence showing that by training them in this way, they were more likely to get a seat. But at the end of the game, I didn't change the structure. There's still going to be two people without seats. And in many ways, what we do with many of our training interventions and our focus on education is change who is getting opportunities, and that's really important. But we have to deal with the structure of the game itself as well. You have to change not just the ability of one person or another to get into the seat, but how many seats there are fundamentally. So I would say, yes, we need to have educational interventions. The unequal investments and the unequal resources and many of the inequalities in schooling are important. But that is the answer that Americans most like to look to is education. And you've got to change the rest of things as well.
So, Joe, are both political parties, I mean, since you're a political scientist, culpable and guilty of doing this, of not... you know, of really continuously redefining the problem, but not really coming up with policy remedies that will actually lead to structural change?
I think it's not you're asking it in a yes or no way, and I guess I'd be hesitant to say, yes, sure. Equal culpability is not the question. The question is, has either party done anything that's fundamentally, right? Mm-hmm. Created a more racially just and equitable system? And my answer would be neither party has gone that far, though in no way are the two parties equal or the same in how they've approached these issues or what they've tried to promote as solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, living in the world of here and now, most ordinary Americans just want real solutions that they can tangibly touch and experience. And I find that most people are really disconnected with the policymaking process and understanding that, you know, on the historical dimension, it's been really less than 60 years since women and people of color and frankly, poor people have had the full rights of citizenship mm-hmm. in terms of casting a vote and having that enforced. So if we talk about the stacked up inheritance and the intergenerationally populations that haven't had transfers across the generations, we can say that this is a large part of America, but most people really don't understand that, or they haven't really thought about it in those terms. So one of the things that I am thinking a lot about these days, and I know Dr. Myers, you have actually done research in this area, and Dr. Soss, you as well, going back to the criminalization of and the punishment of low-income populations and populations of color, sometimes the lack of access to poor mental health services, disability services, have actually led to some of what we're seeing in society. How does health and poverty and race converge? I mean, we've talked a lot about race and we've talked a lot about poverty, but from your perspective, how is staying healthier, being healthier, having access to that in these neighborhoods really affecting how kids and families are performing? Dr. Myers, I'll start with you.
I'm glad that you're asking about health because as Dr. Soss pointed out, things like educational inequality can't be looked at in a vacuum without looking at the nexus of other things. And so one example has to do with suspension rates. So there's this huge racial gap in Minnesota, and particularly in Minneapolis and the St. Paul public schools in suspension rates. And I'm not talking about in-school suspension, I'm talking about out-of-school suspension. And it turns out that there's a very close statistical relationship between math scores and suspension rates, as well as attendance rates. If you're suspended, that means you're not in school. If you're teaching fractions today, that means that you're not going to learn percents tomorrow because all of these different components of math are taught sequentially. But it turns out why are black males and Hmong males and Native males will likely be suspended? And the answer is, we don't know how to maintain order in the class, because the way we're teaching the class is that we're teaching people to sit in their seats and to answer questions, but not to speak up. And so some of the brightest people I know that I grew up with were absolutely misfits in the classroom, but they were brilliant. And so here's the issue of whether, is it possible that there are mental health issues? Is it possible that there are diet issues? Are there possible? So there are actually two things going on, number one. One is the way we teach in our public schools kind of mandates behavior, mandates a particular form of acquiescence to power, to inequality. That's one issue. The second issue is there are some people who have learning disabilities. There are some people who think different ways, and in the absence of good mental health, good physical health, we don't know who they are. And so we just assume that they are criminals. We suspend them, and then they're running the streets, and then they get picked up by juvenile authorities, and they get sucked into the criminal justice system. And we ask the question, what's a cost-effective way in order to solve this problem? And what cost-effective way is get rid of suspension and replace suspension with in-class testing, exercises, valuing and highlighting people's strengths. So somebody draws well, somebody has excellent voice, somebody's able to do abstract thinking. Instead of putting them in a box where they have to memorize something, why don't we put them into a classroom where their innate abilities are being highlighted? And so my main point is that many of the observed inequalities that we have been talking about are intimately related to health. But we've never made that link in the past. We have health over here, we have education over here, we have transportation over here. They're all viewed as separate entities. And maybe we should be developing a more holistic understanding of what these racial disparities mean.
Yep, I think that's an excellent point. And actually it's one of the reasons why at the University of St. Thomas, the College of Health has the programs that relate to family and community factors, as well as just medicine and health interventions. So Dr. Sass, what is your take on health and its relationship with the issue that we're speaking to right now? I'll have you have the last word, and then I'm gonna wrap us up because I can't believe this, but an hour has already gone by. So few thoughts from you and then we'll be done.
I'm gonna connect this to health in a way that makes a broader point about the Minnesota paradox, I hope. I think it's really important. We haven't talked much about how people think and what people want and what people will tolerate and push for in the public in this conversation. And that's, of course, what a lot of people mean with the Minnesota paradox. How is it that people can have these attitudes and want liberal things and still have these inequalities? And I did a study with some people, some colleagues a few years ago on health disparities. And it was very striking. We took the same disparities, and in surveys, we randomized whether we described these disparities. Some people who answered the survey, they were described as disparities along the line of education. For other people, the exact same disparities were described as an income. People who are wealthier have less of this problem than people who are poor. And for a third group, they were described as racial disparities between blacks and whites in particular. And the interesting thing was, relative to the other two, when you took the exact same disparities and described them in terms of race, American people who were surveyed in this study were less likely to be troubled by them, were more likely to believe that there was nothing government could do about them, and were more likely to believe that there was probably some sort of individual or personal or even biological reason why they existed. And so I think we have to reckon here in some ways with the power of race, not just as a social structure, but also as a mental structure. And I think we have to think here a little bit, and this is the final point I'll leave on, Political scientists have been studying for decades what we call the principal policy gap, which is that people will say in a survey that they are absolutely committed to and very much want to close racial gaps, to make to achieve racial equality, and in the very same surveys will decline to support, white Americans will decline to support every possible option that you could pursue for a concrete policy to achieve those things, right? And so in many ways, against that backdrop, Minnesota is not such a mystery. We have a lot of people in this state who would like to say, who say and probably genuinely believe that they would like to have a more racially just state, but they also decline to support, particularly where the rubber meets the road, when people start to talk about changing institutions and policies, decline to support those changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what I've gotten from this conversation, I will wrap up. This was a wonderful dialogue to have with two very prestigious and well-renowned, I would say, scholars. If you include myself, but I'm not doing many scholarly duties now as dean. I would say that the Minnesota paradox has been fueled by a good value system, but that our say-do ratio is pretty low in terms of structural reform. And to narrow that gap in and of itself probably won't solve the problem, which is where we've been fixated and what we've been looking at. Even in the academia, we could ask questions from a different perspective, use the tools that we have, and actually generate better policy solutions to recommend. So I just want to thank both of you so much for your willingness to engage in this conversation. And we will end here. I hope the audience has learned a lot from listening to all of us. I know I have, and I'm grateful to be living in the state of Minnesota, where we have people like Dr. Myers and Dr. Soss who can help us think through these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.